Accession number 12279, Reel 1.
Captain Brown, Reel 1. Could you please tell me how you came to be in the forces in the first place?
Yes, I started off my interest in aviation by joining the University Air Squadron, and thereafter I was called up, of course, at the beginning of the war into the RAF VR, and the Navy at that time, or rather the Fleet Air Arm, had suffered some early losses in the war, and a notice was up on the board in one of the RAF messes saying that Navy was looking, or the Fleet Air Arm was looking for volunteers. So I decided I might have a go at this, because there didn't seem to be much happening in the Air Force establishments I'd been in up to that time.
Which was the first operational squadron that you joined?
The first operational squadron as such was really 802 Squadron, which was a fighter squadron flying Wildcats, or as they were then called, Martlets.
Can you tell me about the squadron, about its leadership and personnel when you joined it?
Yes, it's formed at Donibristle in Fife in Scotland in 1941, and we were all rather young in the squadron. The average age, I should think, was not more than 20, and except for the commanding officer and the senior pilot. Commanding officer was an aviator of considerable experience. He had been a civilian flying instructor and come back into the Fleet Air Arm after a spell, as I say, out in civil life. He was quite a disciplinarian, so he kept us all in pretty good kippers from that point of view. And but at the same time, he taught us a lot about tactics and was, in fact, a very, very good conveyor of information to young people who were avidly looking for to glean something from his experience. And we were divided up into sections, rather than flights in those days, because there were only two in a section. Later on you realize that tactically one tended to get into flights of three, and then later on into sections of four, but we had sections of two in those days. So you were paired up with somebody who was more experienced than you, and I had a fellow Scot who was my section leader, and we stuck together right throughout our operational period in the squadron. And this way, we tended to make quite a good team, I think.
What did you think to flying the Martlet?
Oh, it was a magnificent aeroplane for its day. The Fleet Air Arm had really suffered very badly from inadequate aircraft, due, I think, to a lack of appreciation in the Admiralty of what naval aviation was all about. And when the war came, it caught us with aircraft which were really considerably inferior to those of the enemy. And this was possibly particularly at its worst in the fighter arena. And then suddenly there came these Wildcats from America under the lease-lend arrangement. And they were a total revelation to us, because they had been designed from scratch for area aircraft carrier operations, and they were rugged. They had an innovation in the fact that they had what is called a sting hook, an arrestor hook, which came out of the tail of the aircraft as opposed to being under the belly of the aircraft, which we had. This made it much more simple to catch an arrestor wire than with the belly type. And also they were armed with 0.5 machine guns, which at that time were non-existent in this country. We were all using 0.303, so we were quite heavily armed. And you could also reload these, or recock, not reload them, but recock these aircraft from the cockpit in the event of a jam, which again was an innovative feature. They had an extremely reliable radial engine, and they also had excellent ditching qualities, which for a naval aircraft, of course, was very, very necessary. So altogether, they were extremely popular and very effective.
You were on HMS Audacity. Oh, can you tell me what life aboard that carrier was like in 1941?
Well, of course, the ship itself was an ex-German merchant ship, a banana boat on the Caribbean run. And it was captured in Saint Domingo by the cruiser Dunedin and eventually brought back to the UK. Now, Winston Churchill at this time had the idea that Atlantic convoys required more protection than they were getting merely by surface escorts. And they didn't have air cover once they got outside the range of aircraft operating from the UK or operating from America. So there was a huge gap in the middle with no air cover at all. And his idea was to have small aircraft carriers do this job. And there were, the name Woolworth carrier became part of the thing because later on they were built in huge numbers. But the Audacity was really the first of those. And in this case, all they did was literally slice the top off the ship, put a flight deck on it, a very small flight deck, and it really was a merchant ship with a steel deck on it, and a few RN crew, and the main bulk of the crew were, in fact, merchant navy seamen. It was extremely pleasant ship from the pilot's point of view as regards living accommodation, because there were six staterooms on the ship, six double staterooms and two singles. And the captain insisted that these be given to the pilots. So we lived in rather in state. We had beds instead of bunks, and we had square ports instead of portholes, which we infuriated some of the merchant seamen by calling windows. But and altogether, from that aspect, it was quite pleasant. Of course, it was a difficult ship to fly from because the flight deck was only 420 feet long, which is extremely small, and the flight deck beam was only 60 feet. So you were flying from a very, very small mini carrier. The other thing I should say about it was it only had two arrestor wires. So you had to, it required pretty accurate flying to get on. It had these two wires, but there was then a third wire just immediately before the barrier. We had a crash barrier in case you missed the wires. But if you caught this third wire, which was always nicknamed the For Christ's Sake wire, because if you went into this wire, you were given very, very severe retardation, which possibly could break the aircraft, but if you did pull the wire out to most of its full length, the barrier then collapsed. They were interconnected, so the barrier collapsed and you ran over the barrier. So you could be saved by this third wire. And again, it had no hangar, no aircraft hangar as such, so all the aircraft were up on the flight deck. And this made it a very, very tough business for the maintenance personnel who had to do everything on the flight deck.
Do I understand that your first operations were with 802 Squadron, or had you had some experience of operations before you joined them?
I had had some experience of operations, not operations as such, in a long-term process. I was assigned once to a skewer squadron up in the Orkneys, but that was only for two or three of us went up because they'd had some losses and they needed immediate replacements. And they asked for skewer pilots from 802 to go up. A very temporary assignment. We only did one raid against Norway.
Can you describe what happened on that raid?
Well, that was it was a raid against oil tanks in Bergen. And we had about, I think I'm right in saying there were 12 skewers. And it's a long haul from, of course, the Orkneys, there's Hatston was the name of the actual air station, to Bergen. And we got in, fortunately, without being bothered at all by the enemy. And the bombs were dropped quite successfully, and the oil tanks were set on fire. But then, as we were leaving, we were caught by some ME-109s. And they took their toll. I think we lost three or four off the aircraft. And certainly there was a hairy period when my own self, I was chased up one of the fjords by a 109, and I had to get down to a very, very low level to avoid and to keep close to the fjord wall, to try and minimize his chances of attack. And but they were very determined, and they kept at us, even in those conditions. So it was really a rather rough run. And, of course, if you're damaged, if your aircraft's damaged or anything, you've a very long haul back to the Orkneys, because we were at maximum range at that time.
Why would the Messerschmitts not be able to attack you at low level?
They would be able to attack us at low level, but if you're right down on the water, they can't break away underneath you. And we had a rear gunner, after all, you must remember. They can't break away underneath you. They've got to break up. And therefore, and they can't break up towards the fjord wall. They can only break up to the open side. And if you are up and open, you know which side they're going to go, and they're going to expose their belly for a very few seconds as they go. So that is part of the tactical reason.
Do you know the date when that happened? Was it April 1914, at the beginning of the Norway campaign, or later?
Oh, it was early in 1940, because we'd just formed up, yes. We'd just formed up. It was a very early stage. I'd have to look up my logbook to check that for you. But very early stages.
Because the Norway campaign started in the second week of April, 1940.
Yes.
How did flying the skewer compare with something like the Wildcat?
Well, it was as different as chalk from cheese, really. The skewer, ostensibly, was a dive bomber stroke fighter. It was quite a good dive bomber, but it certainly was a very poor fighter. And it was slow, it was not particularly maneuverable, and it was very much underpowered. Whereas the Wildcat had a very powerful engine. It was quite a light aircraft, very nippy indeed. Rather like an angry bumblebee, frankly. And it was much better armed. It had everything, in fact, that the skewer didn't have. But of course it wasn't meant to be a dive bomber, it was purely a fighter. Well, as the Skua, to its defence, it was meant to do two jobs, and that's always a difficult thing to ask of an aircraft.
What did you feel about dive bombing yourself as a technique?
I liked dive bombing. I thought it's a very exhilarating experience. And I've flown many types of dive bomber, and it is quite interesting to compare them. To my mind, the greatest of those I've flown was the German Ju-87, which was really a superb dive bomber. All the others could dive at angles, pretty steep angles, probably up to 60 degrees, some of them maybe even up to 70 degrees. But the Ju-87, to my mind, was the only truly vertical dive bomber that I've ever flown, where you could actually come down truly vertical. And of course, it's an incredible sensation when you are diving totally vertically, because you feel, in fact, you are over the vertical. You always get that impression as a pilot that you've actually exceeded the vertical. But it was a very accurate dive bomber, and of course it had this marvelous automatic pull-out gear, so the pull-out, which is one of the very difficult things to judge after you release the bomb, your release height and your pull-out can be very, very tight, because you're getting reasonably close to the ground by this stage, but it was all done automatically in the Ju-87. So the Skua was contemporary with the Ju-87, but really not in the same class as a dive bomber.
Now, coming back to the Audacity, what kind of duties was the carrier carrying out when you joined her?
Well, we primarily did two things. We did anti-submarine patrol, which isn't really a fighter's job, but it, we had to, because that's all. These were the only type of aircraft we had. We did a dawn patrol around the convoy first thing, just to see that the area was clear of U-boats, and we did one last thing at night, dusk patrol. So these were the two anti-submarine patrols. Then during the day, we were at immediate readiness for takeoff against the Focke Wulf courier aircraft, which were raiders really against convoys, but in the main, of course, they were providing information to the U-boat Wolf packs, which were frequenting the Atlantic. So they were very, very dangerous aircraft from our point of view. They were also very heavily armed, extremely heavily armed. So they were not an easy target to fight against.
Did you personally have any success against any?
Yes, twice against Focke Wulf couriers.
Can you describe in detail what happened each time?
Well, and the first time we spotted two of these, and my section leader was the one that caught sight of them first, and he called, and he assigned one to me, and he went off to take the other. And I chased mine, and we knew that the main weakness on the courier was that it had a rather weak tail unit. That is to say, on landing, for example, if you made a heavy landing, you could actually snap the fuselage near the tail. So this was a weak point we knew about from intelligence reports. And we'd already had one success with a section actually firing at the tail unit and breaking it off. So this was the point we tended to aim for at first. But I found this difficult in the sense that when I was against this particular courier, he was flying below a fairly low cloud base, just below it. And Therefore, you had to come in very flat, and you had no real chance to break away above them, or you had to break away below, which, of course, is the more desirable way to go. But with the visibility, etc., we were only getting in, or I was only getting in, a 1 or 2 second burst at a time. But on one of these bursts, I did set one of his inner engines on fire, and of course, four-engined aircraft, and he popped up into the cloud, and so I thought I'd lost him completely. It was a fairly thin cloud layer, possibly about 400 feet, so I went above it, and hopefully just that I might see him, that he might pop through it, but he didn't. So and I was just milling around, generally hoping that something would happen, when I saw a wingtip just come out of the cloud. He was obviously turning. So I knew he was turning, and on that basis I thought I would reverse course with him, but I didn't get it quite right, because when eventually he did emerge, I found I was actually head-on to him. And it was the only chance I was going to get. So I came down fairly flat, because I'd realized that the top gun he had, the dorsal gun, it was a cannon actually, couldn't be depressed below a certain elevation. And if you kept very flat, he probably wouldn't be able to fire at you. So I came in, and the main risk at that stage is you have a very high relative closing speed, and there is a great risk of collision, so you've got a very, very short firing time. But after all, we had 4.5-inch machine guns, which is quite a heavy armament, and I just blasted away as I came in the 2 or 3 seconds, and I could actually see the cockpit glass off the on the nose of the aircraft shattering, and before I pulled away. And then it just spiraled down into the sea. So obviously, my guess is that both pilots were killed.
Where was that?
This was out, and we were about in the Bay of Biscay, I suppose 600 to 800 miles due west of Brest, roughly.
And this was 1941?
That's correct.
And the second time?
Second time, that was on one convoy going out to Gibraltar. And on the way back, I had another one, and he was, this time, I had more chance to set myself up with him. He couldn't escape into cloud as easily, so what I did was actually, having found that the head-on attack was very, very successful, we had discussed this within the squadron after that particular combat, and we decided that this was a technique we would try and latch onto, because it was one way of avoiding too many guns being brought to bear on you. So this time I set up the head-on attack from the word go, and it worked out very well indeed, worked out beautifully, and it went the same way as the first one, really. It was much more straightforward, because I didn't have a cloud chase this time.
What were your feelings in combat?
I think everybody, when you see the other aircraft, I think the adrenaline flows a bit. You realize that you're committed to something which may end up with yourself getting killed or wounded, and but it's survival, so you've got to go for it. And I think you realize this. But once you've started in, all that was blotted out of your mind. I think that these thoughts, you're just all concentrated on applying your skills as far as you can against the skills of the other aircraft. And it becomes rather like a jousting event with the knights of old. I think You know, you suddenly lose all worry and fear and trepidation about the whole thing. Get on with it.
And your feelings when you see the enemy plane go down?
You inevitably think of the people who have lost their lives. Inevitably. I think not immediately. I think immediately that happens, you are filled with elation that you've won the contest. But I think maybe in the evening you sit and reflect on it and you think that's somebody's, some mother's son or some child's father, and you think of these things. But you have to put them in the back of your mind, because if you conduct a war on the basis of emotion, you're never going to get anywhere. But they do cross your mind, inevitably.
What about the... did you ever see any U-boats whilst you were on those convoys?
Yes. This was one of the most heavily attacked convoys of World War II, and U-boat sightings were quite frequent. Quite often on the surface, because when we did these patrols, they were quite wide out beyond... we were circling the convoy, but they're quite a distance from the convoy. And the U-boats were surfaced at that distance in order to have the maximum closing speed to get close into the convoy, because once they go under, of course, their speed reduces. And so in the evening in particular, it was quite common to catch them on the surface. And all we could do, we could attack with our guns, but we weren't really going to sink a submarine with 0.5-inch machine guns. But at least we made them keep their heads down and usually caused them to dive. But the main thing we were doing was we were reporting all this back to the convoy commodore, who was directing the whole thing. And he could then direct his anti-submarine destroyers or corvettes to the scene, knowing that he'd had a positive sighting. Fact, in that convoy, which the commodore was the famous Captain Walker, we had tremendous success. A considerable number of U-boats were indeed sunk.
You don't know the name of the convoy?
Yes, it was OG-76, and the major battle was HG-76, coming home from Gibraltar.
How did people feel about the U-boat crews? Did people feel that, any special hatred towards them?
Yes, there wasn't the same attitude towards the U-boat crews as there was towards the aircraft crews. I think there was a lot of anger about the U-boat crews, because the feeling is, rightly or wrongly, that the whole thing with aircraft is done in the open. With the U-boats, it's a furtive approach to try and kill a lot of people without being seen. It's not what you might call a fair battle. And there was a psychological different attitude to the whole thing. And none of us had much sympathy for the U-boat crews, to be frank.
But would you describe it as hatred?